This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey everyone, Gil Gross here, and it is time for another mailbag where I answer your questions, hot takes, observations, and ultimately your comments about tennis or anything else. I post on the YouTube community tab. Comments came in there. Comments also came in on the new Monday Match Analysis Discord server. Yes, it is a new place to leave mailbag comments. It is also a new place to talk about tennis 24/7 with other people who are like-minded, and I have been really blown away by the growth and the participation in the Discord after launching it last week. Link is in the description if you want to get in on the fun. Hope everybody is having a good time with Queens and Halle. And I have 17 comments that I pulled this week. I'll probably go about 45 minutes. We shall see. Let's go to the first one from user. Hey Gil, on grass, people generally say the serve is a massive weapon. We also hear that one of the weaker parts of Alcaraz's game is his serve, and if he had a serve like Federer or Kyrgios, he would be unbeatable. However, do you think that if he did have a serve like that, some other aspects of his game wouldn't be as strong, since he wouldn't need so many ways to win a point if he can hit aces slash serve plus one? Some examples like Tsitsipas or FAA, who can somewhat make up for shaky backhands due to their strong serve and forehands, while players, of course, always try to improve. Do you think having a big weapon makes players less concerned about developing another shot into a weapon? For example, Zverev seems to use his forehand as a setup shot for his backhand to finish. Fascinating question. And I think that developmentally, there's a lot of compelling logic around this, where let's say, for example, you grow up on slow clay courts. We often see players from South America, from Spain. Maybe their serves aren't as big a part of their success. And I talked about this with Hugh Clark on a mailbag a few months back. But if you are a junior and tennis is giving you constant feedback of what's important and what's not, based on the instant gratification of whether or not you won or lost the point. So if you grow up on slow clay, and regardless of what kind of serve you're able to hit, especially as a junior when you're, you know, 10 to 15 years old and your serve probably isn't all that big anyway. But if it doesn't matter how well you serve because the returns just come back in play, that tells you indirectly your environment is telling you that the serve is not as important. And if you're a player like Alcaraz, who probably was beating everybody's butt in every single baseline rally because you're faster and you hit harder and your hands are better and you're more creative and all of that stuff, it's not hard to imagine a scenario where a guy like Carlos Alcaraz grew up without his serve really mattering all that much. And then when he got onto the tour and he's playing the best players in the world, well, now guys can kind of match him in other areas, or at least get closer to him in other areas, and the serve starts to matter more, but it probably didn't for most of his junior career. But just to kind of clarify the point, on the flip side, if you grow up on a super fast surface, let's say you grow up on fast indoor hard courts, well, now you're in an environment where when you hit good serves, you win the point with it all the time, and your offense and your aggression is going to be rewarded as you develop, and therefore you might neglect certain aspects of your game, such as consistency and defense, people who grow up on fast hard courts like in California are, over the years, especially how it used to be, I think the hard courts have even slowed down on a recreational level. But, you know, it's like, okay, these players were usually not as consistent and didn't have as high rally tolerance and normally didn't defend as well. That stuff wasn't rewarded. So there's an incentive system there that could affect development. I also think that, you know, one thing I want to point out is there are some flaws to the argument, right? Because let's say Tsitsipas or FAA didn't have a great serve forehand. Well, then we would have never heard of FAA and Tsitsipas. That's how they make their bread. That's how their top, you know, that's how their top level pros. So there are, you know, sometimes players are going to have strengths and weaknesses. You can't exactly say, well, their weaknesses are only there because of their strengths. I don't think you can blame the weaknesses on the strengths necessarily, because there are plenty of examples of players who have the same weaknesses, a backhand of FAA's quality, of Tsitsipas's quality, who don't end up having the serve forehand, obviously, right? There are plenty of those scenarios. The difference is they might be 350 in the world instead of 8 in the world, right? All right, let's go to the next one. Very philosophical question there. This is a Discord comment from ABXR. In the previous mailbag, you mentioned that Alex de Minaur is not a big analytics guy, but then I started to wonder, what does it actually look like if you are an analytics-focused player? Coming from an American sports perspective, the changes that occurred with the proliferation of analytics were things like baseball teams focusing on on-base percentage and more towards the three true outcomes. Football teams passing more and going for it on fourth down. Basketball teams shooting more threes. Has there been analogous shift in tennis? If not, do you think, so I guess comparable would be the, if you don't know what that word means. If not, do you think this is a common theme for individual sports, or is there something specific to tennis that would make it data resistant? Fantastic question. So basically, have there been trends in tennis in terms of how the sport is played that have been driven by discoveries in data? Because in other sports, that's happened. Not convinced that's really happened in tennis. Maybe. I mean, I have seen more serve and volley in the last 5-ish years. I have seen more drop shots in the last 3-ish years. You know, these things are not new. They're not innovations necessarily, but I just think that they've come back a little bit more. But I'm not convinced that those trends are super analytics driven. I don't think that serve and volley going away in terms of, you know, doing it on every point, I don't think that was analytics driven. I think that was racket technology driven more than anything, you know, and it just kind of, these things sort of develop naturally. Yeah, I'm not sure in tennis that's happened. Now, what does it look like if you're an analytically interested player? I think that means something different for different analytics focused players. But most coaches will tell you, I've heard this many times, including from Darren Cahill, that some players don't want a lot of information. They like to simplify. And other players want you to talk their ear off for 30 minutes about their opponents and the trends and their play style and what they like and what they don't like. And how often do they take their forehand cross versus line? What about on the backhand? What's their preferred serve direction? Let's talk the deuce. Let's talk the ad. Let's talk first serve. Let's talk second serve. Do they come forward? Which volley are they more comfortable with? So you can go very much in the weeds. And it's just a matter of, as a player, how much information are you able to process? How much do you like to process? And what are the particular nuggets that you like to focus on? So one player might feel like, I really like to have an idea of my opponent's serve direction tendencies. But me as a player, and I know I've heard other players say this, I've never been in a position to receive serve direction tendencies, but I don't think I would want to know. Because let's say a coach told me on break point on the deuce, on the ad side, 65% they're going T. The other 35% it's wide. So that's a real trend there. 65% is a statistically significant trend without a doubt. But am I really comfortable selling out for the T serve when the 35% chance is very much in the cards? I don't know. Like, part of me thinks I'd rather read and react to the serve without having that analytical based bias in my head about where I expect the serve to go. I know for a fact some pro players feel that way, and others think, no, I want to lean towards the 65%. So there's a difference there with how players might approach things. It's also a world, before I kind of finish answering this question, I want to qualify. I have a ton to learn in this area. And part of that is because players are very private. They're very secretive because they're trying to get an edge about their analytics. You know, Novak Djokovic, he loves the data. Andy Murray loves the data. But these guys are not going to openly discuss exactly what they're doing when it comes to how they're studying analytics and what specific analytics they're looking at. That stuff is kept under wraps, which is makes it hard for somebody like me to, and you guys, to fully understand exactly what's happening there. Next one from Paul, who is a member. Appreciate that. You can hit the join button. $2 a month contribution to support the channel. It is much appreciated, and I'll try to get you in the mailbag as much as possible when I see that member star. After his win against Alcaraz, Draper spoke about how he is trying to change his identity as a player. He no longer wants to be a grinder and is trying to reinvent himself as a much more attacking player. Are there any other players on the tour that might benefit from this sort of identity change? I know you've mentioned Rune in this regard, but wanting him to go the other way. That's right. Yeah, I've thought that Rune should actually scale back the constant attacking a little bit. There are a lot of players on tour that I've seen make a similar change or have to kind of develop in that direction that Jack has gone. But Casper Ruud is the big one. There have been times, especially last year, where I've looked at the way Casper's played and I've thought to myself, your D isn't that good to play so defensive, right? If you are not using your forehand as the biggest weapon on the court, if you are not in charge with that particular shot, you are not going to be a top eight player. You might be fine. You might be the 13th, 14th best player in the world if you're going to play passive, but you're going to have to take charge with that forehand. So Casper is definitely a big one. And by the way, he has really kind of, I don't want to say made that adjustment this year, but he has recalibrated this year. He's gone back to being a player who's willing to take a lot of chances with his forehand and to move inside the court to hit his forehand. Dimitrov, I think, has gotten more aggressive. I think earlier on, I think he would kind of lean on his athleticism a little bit too much at times. I think Tommy Paul has gotten way more aggressive. Another guy, unbelievably athletic. Like, you cover the court great. And sometimes kind of goes back to what we said about incentives. Because you can go so far, or because you can go it can take you a certain distance in this game, playing a certain way, it incentivizes you to neglect certain things. And Brad Stein has kind of come in and, okay, Tommy, that's great you move well, but you don't hit all that big from the back of the court, so we're going to need to add transition game, taking the ball really early, coming forward, that let's use our athleticism north-south, because Tommy Paul used to use his athleticism east-west, and he was an unthreatening player offensively, because you don't hit big and you're kind of plastered behind the baseline. So how do I feel threatened? I don't. And now when you're playing Tommy, you do feel threatened because he's turned into a baseline hugger who's going to come forward if you drop the ball short. Is that enough examples? Let me just add that the big three, we saw with all three of them, because of age, they started to get more aggressive so that they didn't have to rely as much on their endurance and their movement overall. I think Medvedev hits bigger now than he used to. And I think Zverev comes forward more now than he did when he was a young player. So there are a lot of players who I think have successfully kind of added more aggressive wrinkles to their games. Now, I'm just realizing now that you actually asked me about players who should be more aggressive and aren't. I can't say anyone right now really comes to mind as someone who is playing way too passively and should be doing more. Nothing comes to mind, unfortunately. Let's go to Aiden. Hey, Gil, new fan of your channel here. Love the content. Keep it pushing. And I love to hear that. Thank you and welcome. Was wondering your thoughts on Jack Draper. He seems to be really making it into the spotlight with his first tournament win at Boss and as of today beating Alcaraz at Queens. He looks to be in top gear, looking quite dominant on the grass. What are your predictions about him in Wimbledon? And do you think he has what it takes to rival Rune, Sinner, and of course Alcaraz on other surfaces in the near future? Yeah, watched his match this morning as well at Queens. Lost 6-4 to Tommy Paul. I thought he just hit a wall. I think he looked tired. You could see the energy levels just fluctuating throughout the match. Up, down. Serve wasn't as snappy, wasn't as effective as it has been as of late. So, especially the second serve. Understandable. I'm impressed with how well he rebounded from Stuttgart, but it did seem like against Tommy Paul, who's playing excellent grass court tennis, Draper just kind of ran out of gas. But in general, you're wondering my thoughts on Jack Draper. I think he has such a well-rounded skill set. World-class serve, world-class backhand. I would put both those shots top tier. The way he's been volleying, using the drop shot, it's been a really incredible display of volleying for a guy who wasn't really coming forward enough, I don't think, until Wayne Ferreira came in and probably said, let's get in more, because he's really skilled up there. So that has stood out. And if the forehand is a weakness, it is a really good weakness. It really is. And I do think it's a weakness, but I think it's a super strong weakness. The movement is excellent, so I don't know really where the hole is with Jack. And, now he's starting to kind of build the offensive game as we just discussed. Still has a long way to go before I use, I talk about him in the same breath as Sinner and Alcaraz. I am higher on him coming into Wimbledon than Rune probably. But I will say about Wimbledon, I'm sure I'll elaborate on this more in the future. It's not going to be easy for Jack at Wimbledon. As much as I've been impressed with his grass court play, and as much as I love his skill set in general, he comes into Wimbledon as, for the first time, as a guy who has some real expectations on his shoulders. Andy Murray, it's his last Wimbledon. So it's kind of all eyes on Draper to take the mantle and run with it. Usually a couple go-rounds where you start to get used to feeling that pressure, I think helps. Now, everything I've seen from Jack so far suggests that his maturity levels are really high. His ability to embrace the bright lights and the biggest stages is really, really good. But this is like a different level, I think, when you are the number one Brit at Wimbledon and that the expectations start to grow. I'd be a little bit worried about Draper from a mental standpoint, given that this will be his first experience taking the full brunt of British expectations at Wimbledon. And it's not the same as Queens. It's just not. Next one from Leo F. Hubie Hurkacz's movement and balance is actually so underrated. The fact that he can slide open stance on all surfaces and on both wings is absurd at 6'5". I've also noticed that he is one of the few players that actively slide on grass as well. I agree with you, but it's complex. I agree with you that his movement and balance is so underrated, but I also think there's a reason why it's underrated. Let me put it this way. If Hurkacz came around in, I don't need to go back even that far. If Hurkacz came around in 2010, all people would say is, oh my God, he moves so well for his size. Unbelievable movement for his size. It's all anybody would say. But the thing is, that was being said about Del Potro. Medvedev and Zverev have come along since. Haven't they kind of changed the bar here for how well a big guy can move? Hurkacz does not move as well as Medvedev and Zverev. He doesn't. And if he did, if he was really as quick as them, he'd break serve more. Even though the ground stroke speeds and just the ball striking in general doesn't really do him any favors when it comes to winning baseline rallies. Still, if he was covering the court as well as Medvedev and Zverev, he would break serve at a much higher clip than he does, which is, you know, close to the bottom of the barrel among top 50 players. So, you know, I think you're right. He does move really well. He is really balanced. But the reason it's underrated is because Medvedev and Zverev have completely changed the calculus. Next one from Marjorie. Hey, Gil, wanted to hear your opinion on journalists daring to criticize players who opted to skip the Olympic Games. I think players know what's best and what's good for their career. Why can't we just accept that the Olympics mean more to some people like Iga or Novak and less to others like Pete Sampras, for example? And that's okay. I'm pretty much in lockstep with this comment. It needs to be respected as a personal decision, just because especially because there's such compelling arguments both ways. Like there are really good reasons to value the Olympics. Obviously, it's the ability to represent your country, and it can mean a lot to your people, depending on where you're from, right? And I think the Poles are such a proud people. The Serbs are such a proud people. That means a lot to Iga and Novak, as the comment alluded to. There's that part. But I would go a little bit further. Like, let's go to a guy like Taylor Fritz. You know, he is American. The United States is not going to be like super locked in and engaged on Fritz playing tennis until maybe he were to, let's say, make the gold medal match. But let's say a guy even like Taylor, who comes from the U.S., let's say he wins the gold. First of all, that immediately becomes line number one on his resume when it comes to his legacy. I don't want to hear about Indian Wells, you know, and I understand that from a tennis standpoint, we all know how much it means to win Indian Wells. But the random dude at the bar probably has never heard of Indian Wells. When you put your grandkid on your lap, and this is something that Nico Pereira said to me recently that really I thought was such a true statement. When you put your grandkid on your lap, and you tell them about what your grandfather did back in his day as a youth, the Olympics, it needs no explanation. It needs no further context. Everybody knows what they are. Everybody knows what it means. Everybody wants to take a picture with your medal once you've won a medal. Bob and Mike Bryan have talked about this. Tim Mayotte has talked about this. You win a medal, it becomes the thing in your trophy cabinet that everybody immediately is most infatuated by. So if Taylor Fritz were to win the gold medal, it would become line number one. And by the way, it would raise his profile, in my opinion, overall, like on a, in the U.S. I think it would raise his profile in a significant way. Anyway, on the other hand, you're asking players to play the clay swing, play Roland Garros, get ready for the grass in 3 weeks, play Wimbledon, go back to the clay, play the Olympics, now go to the hard court, Cincinnati, well, Canada, Cincinnati, U.S. Open. There's no time to rest for a four-month period, and it's a really tough ask. Now, maybe it can be done, and it will be done by some players, but you're telling me that instead of getting the rest that I need, I'm going to go to Paris to play a tournament that offers me no rankings points, which potentially, depending on my level, can actually take money out of my pocket, depending on whether or not it inhibits my ability to qualify for certain events down the road, or inhibits my ability to play the Canada, Masters 1000 in Canada, or even the Washington, D.C. event or something like that. It takes money out of my pocket. So I'm losing money to play the Olympics. I'm potentially losing rankings points as a result of playing the Olympics. And by the way, I know that some federations take care of the players who play, so sometimes you can make money, and I'm pretty sure that they've introduced some prize money for gold medalists this year, but obviously there's only going to be one gold medalist. You completely understand why the Olympics seem like a nuisance in the tennis calendar for a lot of players who simply just aren't incentivized to go play. I'm putting myself in their shoes. You know, again, if we're going back to the fact that it's a personal decision, my curiosity when it comes to the Olympics as an experience, I think would override it all, you know? So that's where I do get worried that players are prioritizing their short-term career on tour or their short-term kind of prospects on tour. And they're passing up on an opportunity, an experience, a lifetime experience that, I don't know, maybe you can't put a price on that. Maybe that's more important than the City Open and the National Bank Open. I don't know. For me, that's where I would stand, but I would never care to criticize a player for the Olympic decision when there are so many factors, by the way, including the surface change being physically demanding and physically risky for a player, let's say like Emma Raducanu. Like, she's not going to the Olympics. I don't think, first of all, it's clay and she doesn't have much of a chance to, I don't think, do much at the Olympics if she did play. But also it's tough on the body to change surfaces so much. A lot of good reasons not to play.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Next one from Coyd. Hey Gil, hope you're doing well. I was wondering about Yannick after this Roland Garros going into the rest of the year. He has now had two straight losses to Alcaraz and has really beaten everyone else with ease, with a couple of exceptions, obviously. I know he's clearly been the best player in the world over the last 6 months, but do you think he needs to make any changes to his game? Does he need to add anything or improve anything, either physically, technically, or tactically, to counter Alcaraz? Or do you think he just needs to focus on the mental side and play better in their uniquely pressured encounters? Thanks as always. I'm glad you asked this. I came away from certainly the Roland Garros match from Sinner's perspective feeling like there are no drastic adjustments that need to be made. Now at Indian Wells, I thought he looked kind of shaky physically in the third set, but also he was clearly bothered by Alcaraz's tactic to put more air under the ball. In Paris, I do think he responded and reacted to that tactic in a way that was effective, to just take the ball, to step inside the court and to take the ball more on the rise, to try to not back up on the ball so much when Alcaraz introduces the high heavy stuff. But the overarching kind of feeling that I had after watching the match at RG is Sinner didn't serve well and he didn't move well. So there's nothing long-term in his game that I think he needs to panic about or worry about. The fact is, if you play a guy as good as Carlos Alcaraz, you're going to need to serve well. You're going to need to move well. There's no getting around those two things. For Yannick's movement, especially to his right, to his forehand side, looking as, I don't know if the word is compromised, but suboptimal, looking as suboptimal as it did, and him not having a very good serving day, and they're playing the match on clay to begin with, which Sinner probably feels like is presents a stiffer challenge against Alcaraz than hardcourt and grass. I don't think you look at that loss, which was a five-set loss, and you think, I need to change something in any significant way next time I play Alcaraz. I'm sure there will be small stuff when they look at the match, very, very minute details that they might want to do differently, but nothing huge. Didn't serve well, didn't move well. You're not going to win the match that way. Next one is from TD07. Hi, Gil. Thanks for the consistent content. My question is about Wimbledon contenders. Obviously, Alcaraz and Sinner are tier one contenders. Djokovic, if he plays. But who do you put in tier two? For me, it's difficult because most of the guys have had less success at Wimbledon. I'd probably go with Hurkacz and Dimitrov due to strong grass pedigrees and recent form. Maybe also Zverev due to his improved serve this year and volleys. I would also say Medvedev, but his serving stats are way down this year, and that's going to be an even bigger issue on grass. This is an interesting one. What do our Wimbledon tiers look like? Well, it's almost like it feels like there's a tier one and then there's an empty tier two, like nobody's there, and then a crowded tier three. It's kind of what it feels like, but that's not really how tiers work. You can't leave one empty. But I just wanted to make the point that I don't really think that there is even a third guy or a fourth guy. Again, it does depend on Djokovic is going to play. I don't think that there is a secondary contender that you feel anywhere near as good about compared to Sinner and Alcaraz and Djokovic. I think Medvedev and Zverev need to go in tier two because of all they've done. Look, Zverev, I don't like him on grass very much, but I still think he has to be in the tier two. Medvedev, I do think needs to be in the tier two, especially after making the Wimbledon semifinal last year, looking good doing so until going up against Alcaraz. The difference is, because that's normal, like we've gone into a lot of slams recently saying, all right, you know, you have your tier one guy, then you have Medvedev, you have Zverev, oftentimes in the tier two category. The difference is I think there are a bunch of others right there with Medvedev and Zverev in the tier two. I think Hurkacz is there for me. Dimitrov is there for me. Alex de Minaur is there for me. Those guys are right on par to me, on grass with Medvedev and Zverev. Hurkacz, Dimitrov, de Minaur. Rublev and Tsitsipas probably outside of that tier right now. I would not put them in that tier two. And then there are some outside guys who I really do like. Jack Draper, Tommy Paul, Talon Griegspoor, Matteo Berrettini, Jan-Lennard Struff. I'm not saying all those guys are the same. There are some I like more than others. But, you know, these are guys who I think definitely sneak into tier three at Wimbledon. On par with Rublev and Tsitsipas. I don't know. When Struff beat Tsitsipas, that didn't feel surprising at all. Not even a little bit. If Berrettini played Rublev tomorrow at Wimbledon, 50-50 match. So I think what you have for Wimbledon this year is just a little bit more crowdedness after the top contenders, where you look at some of the guys who are lower down in the rankings and you put them next to Medvedev or Zverev or Rublev or Tsitsipas, who are traditionally kind of those outside contenders at the slams. And you're looking at some of these guys and you're thinking, no, actually those, they're the same. Like they're on equal footing. Next one from North. This one is more generic, but can you give your assessment as to why a single-hander is so much harder to defend with, especially on fast surfaces? In theory, it should be possible to get a similar level as a forehand, or is there something biomechanical causing the disparity? Is it just lack of focus on training? Example, do pros like most of us hit a lot more forehands over their lives? No, it's not a training thing. I do think that you're biomechanically, you're oversimplifying it because the one-hander is hit with one hand and the forehand is hit with one hand. The fundamental difference is a forehand is a right, if you're a righty, a forehand is a right arm dominant shot on the right side of your body. A backhand is still a right arm dominant shot on the left side of your body. So even though, yes, it's a one-armed shot, in reality, a two-handed backhand is much more similar to a forehand than a one-handed backhand. Because if a righty has a left-hand dominant two-handed backhand, they're actually coming close to hitting a lefty forehand. That's how I think you should look at it, to try to understand the biomechanical similarities and differences of a forehand. And therefore, just based on your logic, if you're saying, why is it so much easier to defend on the forehand than the backhand on a one-hander, it is easier if the dominant hand in the rally is involved on the side of your body that you're actually hitting the ball on. And like one way you could also think about it is like, think about open stance. You can't really hit an open stance one-handed backhand. I've seen Stan hit it before, but you can't really do it because I don't actually want to verbally try to get into the nitty-gritty of why you can't hit an open stance one-handed backhand, because I just think that in communicating this, I'm going to fall flat on my face. But you can't really do it, right? With your two-hander, you absolutely can. And it makes it a lot easier to defend on the backhand that you can just hit your open stance. it's much easier to use that left arm to defend the backhand than to have to rely on using the right arm. That's why you see a lot of backhand slice when the one-handers are trying to defend. From Powell, also a Discord question. Hello there. Was Federer better at drop shots than Alcaraz? I don't think so. I think Alcaraz is a little bit better than Federer at drop shots. I think frequency matters a lot with the droppers. How big a part of your game is hitting drop shots? For Carlitos, it's a much bigger part of how he's successful and what he does. Now, I do think that Federer's backhand drop shot was probably on average a better executed backhand drop shot than Alcaraz's backhand drop shot. But I think Alcaraz hits his better on the forehand than Federer, plus a lot more often. And if I'm going to choose between Alcaraz's forehand drop shot and Federer's backhand drop shot, I would take Alcaraz's forehand drop shot because the threat of power that comes out of the drive is more likely to put an opponent on their heels, and it's more likely to kind of wrong foot them, take away a little bit of the jump and the anticipation that might be on offer when you see the grip change or the take back change on a backhand drop shot. So I would take Alcaraz overall as a drop shotter. From Hertor, hi Gil, reflecting on Draper beating Alcaraz, it was notable that Ferreira wasn't there for that match. I can't help feeling that it would have really helped Carlos come up with a way to win the match if Ferreira were there. How important do you think Ferreira is in helping solve problems for Carlos in his game? And does Carlos struggle strategically when he's not there? There is certainly some evidence that Alcaraz and his problem-solving skills, his ability to turn matches around when things aren't going well, are diminished when Ferreira isn't in his box. There are plenty of matches where I can think of that happening. So I think it's a real thing. And look, I think Ferrero's a really good coach. Alcaraz is a really good listener, a really good student. It should be helpful that Ferreira is in the box. If you make coaching legal, you should expect that some player-coach combinations are able to optimize it in a way where it's meaningful. It gives the player an advantage. That's what should happen when coaching is legalized. I also think that there can be people who just go way overboard in really gauging the importance of Ferreira for Alcaraz's game. At the end of the day, Carlos Alcaraz is one of the best tennis players in the world, if not the best, because his forehand is better, because his backhand is great, because he moves faster, because he volleys better, because he drop shots better, because he defends better, because his kick serve is great. He's more creative because he has more options. Did I mention he hits harder? Did I mention he moves faster? Yeah. The raw abilities of Carlos Alcaraz are superior to basically everybody else. So do not tell me that it's because Ferreira says, hey, do this, stand there, add some more, work the point a little bit more, hit with a little more height, slice your backhand, serve more to his forehand. Don't tell me that can make Alcaraz number one in the world. It can't. Alcaraz is who he is because of his skill set, not because of coaching. And by the way, he won Queens last year without Juan Carlos Ferreira. He won Indian Wells last year without Juan Carlos Ferreira. Those are pretty big tournaments. Pretty hard to win Queens and Indian Wells if the key to Alcaraz's success is Ferreira. It's not. It's a big help when Ferrero's there, but it's not what makes Carlos Alcaraz good. Next one from Leo F. What do you think contributes to Korda's recent success on grass? In my opinion, Korda looks like he doesn't want to play longer rallies in his matches. I've observed that he often goes for a high difficulty shot, mostly changing directions down the line when the point drags out. The grass court reduces average length of rallies, so therefore favors Korda. Yeah, I think you're onto something. You're going in the right direction. I would just kind of alter the way you communicate it, which is that it's not that because grass reduces the average length of rallies, that's why Korda plays better. It's because it's not a causation. It's a correlation. Korda is great on grass because his baseline game is so damaging on grass, because his ball is on the flatter side. It's on the, you know, it's on the lower side. And his baseline aggression is just extraordinarily deadly on the grass. So that is why, because aggression is rewarded more on grass, that is why the rallies are shorter. It is also why Korda is better on grass. Because yes, it is more difficult to defend against him, more difficult to drag out rallies. And when you do, you're right, Korda has a consistency problem. Korda has a bit of a rally tolerance problem. That doesn't matter as much because Seb finds finishes so easily on the surface because his game is so deadly. So for the same reason the points are shorter, that's why Korda is good. From SJ, hi Gil, I saw this debate online. Rank the following four players career-wise on grass: Dimitrov, Raonic, Medvedev, Kyrgios. When I first saw this, I thought Raonic. And then I looked at the numbers a little bit, and yeah, it's Raonic. It's Raonic by far. Obviously, with grass results, the Wimbledon stuff is going to kind of overshadow and outweigh everything else, particularly because there's no Masters 1000 on grass. You know, year-end championships isn't played on grass either. But if you just look at Wimbledon, Raonic, four times quarterfinal or better, a semifinal, and a final. Well, there's only one other guy on this list, by the way, who's made another Wimbledon final. That's Kyrgios. Not to take anything away, but he didn't need to win a semifinal match. Meanwhile, Raonic beat Roger Federer. So there's a difference there. Dimitrov, only one time quarterfinal or better. That was the semi in 2014. Medvedev, only one time quarterfinal or better. That was the semifinal last year. Kyrgios, two times quarterfinal or better. The breakthrough quarter in 2014, and then the runner-up in 2022. So Raonic has twice the number of quarterfinals, and he's got the final, and the more impressive final, the more impressive run when you compare it to what Nick did, because the draw was quite kind to Nick. You know, Dimitrov won Queens in 2014. That was actually the last year it was considered a 250, but nothing that any of these four did at other grass court events, I believe, even comes close to making up for the fact that Raonic has the best Wimbledon resume out of all those guys. All right, let's do one more. Do JS. I miss watching Ash Barty, particularly when grass season rolls around. I have two Ash-inspired questions. First, is any player WTA or ATP constructing points like she did? What players use an offensive backhand slice with high frequency? First, I'll just answer that real quick. I would say Muhova is the closest to Barty in how she uses her backhand slice and how awesome the backhand slice is. People might say Jabeur, but Jabeur really does prefer her backhand drive. Yeah, Jabeur's got a good slice, but I do think she gets away from it quite a bit, and she prefers to drive the backhand. Muhova's the only player who I think, similar to Ash, wants to set up the forehand and will use the runaround footwork quite aggressively off of the backhand slice. So she'll go backhand slice cross court, look for the forehand on the next ball in a way that really reminds me of Ash. So Karolina Muhova would be my answer for that. Okay, second one. I remember when Iga took over number one after Ash's retirement, she mentioned that she had been practicing against slices in preparation for future matchups with Ash. In your view, what would that have looked like? How would Iga neutralize the slice, and where would she attack? They did play each other a few times, but I think Iga was just on the cusp of becoming the dominant player she is now. Well, Iga, to my eyes, hasn't really developed much of a backhand slice of her own. So what she was probably training is getting up to the ball really, really quickly. So even though the slice stays low, let's not let it drop too low on us. Let's at least get up to the ball in a way where it's not going to drop lower than it needs to. Let's drive down with our legs, you know, to really lower the center of gravity as much as possible. And to try to hit a topspin backhand that has enough RPM to get up and down, probably mostly on a cross-court trade. If Barty hits a good slice, you're not really going to be able to attack it much. But yeah, I think it's probably just getting really comfortable hitting low contact point drive backhands from inside the baseline. And if you get comfortable with that shot, you're going to be kind of ready to handle Barty's slice. But the other thing that can enter the equation is the runaround forehand, which Iga, I'd say she likes it. She doesn't love it, especially for someone with such a big, heavy forehand. She could probably do it more. But the fact that the backhand slice is a slower shot, therefore spends more time suspended in the air, it does give you more time to run around. So that's another thing that Iga could have potentially looked at against Barty, is can we take Barty's backhand slice and just hit forehands off of it? A forehand which is going to be obviously an easier shot to generate heavy topspin on, and that's going to make, you know, the whole getting the ball up and down, that whole thing, it's going to be a whole lot easier if we hit a forehand. So those would be the options for Iga. All right. That'll just about do it. I will talk to you on Monday, match analysis to break down the Queens final and the Holla final. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.